Our next speaker is Linda Burnham, one of the theoretical leaders of a new the new journal, the editorial board of that new journal, which we can all subscribe to outside, Crossroads.
Good evening. First of all, I want to thank Abdul and the Center for Research on Malcolm for having had the inspiration and the perseverance to put together this conference. It will take months for each of us to process all of the information and the analysis and the reflection and the debate that folks have shared yesterday evening and today. And surely by tomorrow evening, we will all be on overload. But it has been a great opportunity, unlike any other that I've participated in for a very long time, to engage in a summation of Malcolm's legacy that is both serious and accessible with sisters and brothers from a great variety of political perspectives. So again, I want to thank all the organizers of this conference for making this great gathering possible, and maybe we can make that a collective thank you. I also want to thank the organizers for providing this panel with such a provocative topic. Is Black liberation and social revolution on the agenda, or is Malcolm out of date? First, the short answer. As long as Malcolm can generate the kind of intellectual and political energy that has been generated here today, Malcolm is not out of date. As long as young people look to Malcolm as a symbol of militant resistance and struggle, Malcolm is not out of date. And as long as the conditions we face as African Americans worsen day by day, week by week, and year by year, then Malcolm's passion, his absolute passion for liberation, is worthy of emulation, and it is not out of date. But those are the easy answers. They're true and they're important, but they're just a starting point, the easy stuff. Because posing the question of Malcolm's relevance today requires that we grapple not only with the power and the beauty of his commitment to freedom, but also with the ideas about how to achieve liberation that were an expression of his commitment. And grappling with Malcolm's relevance means coming to terms with the political context that shaped his thinking, what elements of that context were specific to that period, what elements were time-bound and now historically superseded, and which ones remain part of the political equation today. And finally, especially to those of us of a certain age, coming to terms with Malcolm's relevance also means coming to terms with ourselves, because we too were shaped by the same broad political context that influenced Malcolm. And after all, Malcolm has done his work and is gone, and the issue is not so much whether Malcolm is out of date, but whether we are out of date. So what was that political context that shaped Malcolm? Briefly, as a product of the streets of Detroit and Harlem, Malcolm learned well what every other African American in post-World War II urban America learned, that the centuries-old equation of North equals freedom and the hopes of migrants moving from South to North had been dashed by decades of active, brutal discrimination and malign neglect. That though some blacks might improve their situation relative to what it had been previously, the gap between blacks and whites in income, wealth, community services was wide and constantly widening. That the illusion that loyal service in World War II, in the military, and in the war industries would bring the regard and respect of white America was just that, an illusion. That the local police had more the character of an occupying army than keepers of the peace, and that the post-war economic boom was color-coded and frustrated the dreams of millions of black Americans. Malcolm reached political maturity in an era when the deep frost of the late 40s and the early 50s was beginning to thaw, but at the same time, the rotten underside of liberalism, Kennedy style, was increasingly exposed. The ongoing co-conspiracy of Northern and Southern Democrats had made a mockery of the so-called democratic process for African Americans. And maybe most importantly, part of that political context, the fact that the hub of the black struggle had been in the South, and that the issues it tackled while affecting blacks nationwide were really specific to that region in the civil rights movement. For the de facto barriers to blacks went up in the North more quickly than the de jure ones came down in the South. And the de facto ones were set in concrete. In my opinion, Malcolm mistakenly belittled the struggle to end legal segregation. But it is true that the program that blacks were moving behind in the South was not immediately transferable to the urban ghettos of the North. And Malcolm grasped this problem and struggled to work with it. In the broadest strokes, that was Malcolm's context here at home. But as much as Malcolm was a product of mid-20th century urban America, he was also a product of a particular era in world history. As he matured politically, he remained very much attuned to the struggle for liberation on the continent and throughout the Third World. And the enormous contribution that he was able to make, to an extent unmatched by any mass leader, was to raise up the African in us, to grasp the tremendous significance of the anti-colonial struggle and the victories of post-World War II period, to articulate to us consistently and powerfully, to link our own liberation as African Americans to that of Africans on the continent. Malcolm taught us Ghana. He taught us Kenya. He taught us Algeria and Northern and Southern Rhodesia, so-called. He taught us the Congo. He insisted that the psychology of liberation require that we understand that whites and imperialists were minority peoples in the world context, and that the strategy of liberation required cultivating a base of support beyond the borders of the U.S. In Malcolm's time, the vulnerabilities of European colonialism and imperialism were exposed, and great optimism flourished about the immediate possibilities of righting the wrongs of hundreds of years' duration, gaining not only sovereignty and dignity, but also a way out of the poverty, illiteracy, and economic bondage. And many, in righting those wrongs, were taking the non-aligned or socialist path. This, then, was the international context that framed Malcolm's thinking. That was then. This is now. What about 25 years later? On the home front, the unemployment rate for African Americans is higher in 1990 than it was in 1960. The gap between black and white wealth is wider. The incarceration rate is higher, as is the dropout rate. And as we slide into another recession, the wage rate of black men in constant dollars has not yet recovered to the level it was before the last recession. In other words, we are getting ready for a long, deep slide from a position behind where we were 10 years ago. And as the U.S. made the transition from a manufacturing base to an information service-based economy, whites and businesses have fled the cities, leaving behind a crumbling infrastructure and an economic base that is too anemic and too distorted to sustain the people of color, you and me, left behind. There's certainly nothing about the profile of urban America 25 years after Malcolm that would lead you to believe that the problems black Americans face will be resolved if things are just left to run out their natural course. In spite of the fact that many indicators have worsened in the last 25 years, though, there's also no denying that the spirit of rebellion and the revolutionary current that took hold in a mass way in the 1960s has been tamped down. It's not just that the revolutionaries of the 60s didn't produce a revolution, or even come close in my opinion, but that the radical and revolutionary elements of that period were scattered and fragmented, both by the state and by self-destructive internecine wars. And two, the rising tide of liberation that buoyed up Malcolm has ebbed. Undoubtedly not forever. It is true resistance that oppression breeds resistance, but sometimes it takes a very long time. But at least for the present, the nations that won their independence grapple with what Malcolm called dollarism in the form of the IMF, in the form of free trade zones, in the form of Caribbean Basin initiatives. And the successful revolutions in Mozambique and Angola are mired in seemingly intractable problems of development. At the same time, third world revolutionaries who are battling backward repressive regimes struggle to transform tactics that have become old and ineffectual. And finally, after 70 years, one revolutionary alternative to capitalism, for 70 years, one revolutionary alternative to capitalism has been socialism. But in the past 5 years, European socialism has been through the shredder. I can't agree with the brother earlier today who characterized this as counter-revolution. To my mind, people have thrown off a system that was not working for them, not working economically, politically, spiritually, or any other kind of way. But the fact still remains that the demise of socialist Europe has created an enormous void and strengthened the hand of capital. These are some of the elements of our reality, many of them different from the world Malcolm encountered 25 years ago. For those of us following in a radical or revolutionary tradition, many of the old questions and issues of decades past have not been adequately answered, but new ones have been piled on. To name a few, on the issue of unity, on the issue of allies, on the issue of strategy, on the issue of organization. First, the issue of unity. Are we ready yet to acknowledge that ideological struggle is not a winner-take-all game, and that ideological diversity is a permanent feature of our communities? Nationalism, socialism, and radical reformism all have long and strong traditions in black America. Who among us is so closed-minded that we have not learned something valuable from the discourse of to-the-bone nationalists or dyed-in-the-wool socialists or longtime radical Democrats? For me, at this point in history, I'm ready to deal with anybody this side of obstructionism and collaboration. When we truly learn to value that diversity of ideological and theoretical opinion and find the ground for political cooperation, then we will have made a step forward and followed in the footsteps of Malcolm. On the issue of allies, I heard that heretics are no longer burned at the stake, so I'm going to pose something that some might find a little heretical. Are we secure enough in the uniqueness and power of our culture, our intellectual tradition, our tradition of struggle, our heroes and heroines, to question the ranking, the hierarchy of oppression that most of us operate from? Are we yet beyond dealing with Indian brothers and sisters from the framework of, yes, I know about the genocide, I know about the land grab, I know about the astronomical dropout rate, the alcoholism, the theft of fishing and land rights, but line up right here behind me and mine. Are we ready to turn to our Puerto Rican brothers and sisters yet and say, yes, I know about the AIDS, the devastation of drugs, unemployment, but right behind me, here, behind me and mine, with the Mexicans earning $3.25 in the factory in the fields with a cancer rate of children from the pesticides, can we grasp and understand the specialness, the distinctiveness, the particularity of our oppression, of our struggle, but let up on the preeminence, consciousness and conscience of masses of white folks is not to be taken lightly, while at the same time galvanizing a black constituency. And his Rainbow Coalition was one way of bridging the duality that faces all of us as a central strategic question. On the issue of organization, we have traditionally revered those leaders who provided us with political vision, inspirational and oratorical genius. Are we ready to nurture and revere equally organizational genius that may express itself in quieter and less charismatic form? Are we ready to recognize that oftentimes our political visionaries do not leave behind strong organizational legacy, may themselves unconsciously obstruct the growth of organization? But we must develop the same respect that will anchor the radical and revolutionary black tradition, taking us through the lean and mean times, sustaining the continuity that will enable us to systematically accumulate lessons and victories. We here are radicals and revolutionaries in a country and an era that is implacably hostile to radicalism, much less revolutionism. Despite that hostility, one of our tasks is to know and test the possibilities of our time and place, encourage every effort to revitalize revolutionary theory and spirit, engage the kinds of questions I have posed here tonight and those each of you must have. I want to close with a very brief story. It's a horror story and also a story about the free market. Sometimes those two things go together. Oftentimes those two things go together. I'm sharing it with you even though I know all of you have heard a lot of horror stories about urban life in America because it has haunted me since I heard it more than a year ago. There's a Brooklyn shelter for pregnant women, one, I think the only one in the city. You can only stay in it if you are pregnant. What has 20th century America bred there? First of all, it's bad enough that there are pregnant homeless women. But in Brooklyn, around this shelter, there has developed a market in the urine of pregnant women. Women who are pregnant sell their urine for the necessities of life. Women who are not pregnant sell their urine in order to get into the shelter to have a roof over their heads. This is what 20th century free market capitalism has bred. And as long as this is the other side of the free market, I, for one, cannot share the unbridled enthusiasm of Poles, Hungarians, and Czechs for the free market.